Our concept of justice seems to oscillate a bit in society between harsh punishment for criminals on one hand and rehabilitation on the other. Notice what's missing in either of those, some kind of true accountability. Serving time is not the same thing as having to provide some kind of explanation or accounting for actions. Restorative justice is meant to put meaningful accountability at the center of the justice process. It involves input from both offender and victim, where possible. And restorative justice has uses outside the criminal justice system. It is part of the name of what was once called Mediation Works, based in Medford. It is now called the Resolve Center for Dispute Resolution and Restorative Justice. Resolve is helping host the Northwest Justice Forum in Ashland next week. Let's dig into some of the concepts of restorative justice. Kara Walsh is Resolve's Director of Restorative Justice and sitting here in the studio with me. Kara, good to see you.
Hi, nice to be here. Thank you.
And Raphael Rafi Kunkel is the Director of Education and School Services at Resolve, back in the studio with me again for the first time in a couple of years. Good to see you back here.
Good to see you, too. Thanks for having us.
So with the name change at what was Mediation Works, did the mission change as well, Kara?
The mission did not change. We're sort of in process right now, but really we changed the name because we really acknowledge that we do so much more than mediation works. Mm-hmm. So we extended it to be Resolve Center for Dispute Resolution and Restorative Justice, really acknowledging that the services we do is not just about conflict, but really about responding to harm in our community.
So can anybody really pinpoint a birthplace and a time for restorative justice, when the concepts began to emerge, or whether they came out of something else?
Well, restorative justice is actually quite ancient and indigenous. If we look back to our ancestors and indigenous cultures or traditions, it's really how they naturally responded to harm. They would sit around and really understand the interconnectedness of our relationships and community. And when something would happen, they would naturally come together and say, who's been harmed? What do they need? Whose obligation is it to repair it? And what's the best process to move it forward? So a lot of indigenous cultures still practicing it. And I think us as Westerners are really learning these principles and how to really integrate them into our systems and policies and ways of being.
But then by today's standards of criminal justice, at least in the last, I don't know, 200, 500 years or something, it seems like this is not the way we've gone. It's more about walling parts of society off from one another physically. And so this represents a bit of a change from that, doesn't it?
It's definitely a paradigm shift. It really expands the concept and idea of justice, of really recognizing that we need collaborative, inclusive processes to really identify who has been harmed and what they need and what's the best process in terms of really being able to move forward.
And so in your role, Rafi Kunkel, mm-hmm. as Director of Education and School Services, I mean, we've talked about the last time I think you were here, we were talking about the use of restorative justice in school settings. But does your role go beyond that? I mean, are you helping it be applied in places outside of schools, too?
My primary role and focus is really supporting our K-12 school systems regionally in taking restorative justice principles and practices and using them in school settings as a whole entire school. And I think the shift there is really not only how are we looking at how we respond to harm in a school setting, like if there's been a rule that's been broken or there's a conflict that's come up, but how are we actually proactively building community and relationship in the first place so that when we need to restore something, we actually have a really positive sense of relationship and community to restore things back to.
Is there a sense then that what you do in K-12 can help later on because people have these concepts, at least have some exposure to them earlier in life?
Yeah, I think nationally we look at this trend that's happened called the school-to-prison pipeline, and we really recognize that when students are excluded from their positive school communities and they experience suspensions and expulsions, they're more at risk for dropping out, they're more at risk for engaging in the criminal justice system. So we're really hoping to keep kids in school where they can still be held accountable and at the same time really benefit from those positive pro-social communities.
So beyond the school system, though, is restorative justice being used? Are the techniques and practices being used within the criminal justice system, for example, within Jackson County where you're based?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have a strong partnership with Jackson County Community Justice, particularly the juvenile department. And we have several different services that we provide. We provide accountability classes and coaching to youth offenders to really support them in understanding the impact of their actions, looking at their thinking errors, look at the ripple effect of how their actions have affected other people, and help them understand that when we cause harm, we have an obligation to repair it. And while that's happening, we reach out to crime victims and really make sure that they're supported and empowered in the justice process. And when it's safe and it's appropriate, and we facilitate processes to bring everybody together.
That's a big question right there, because as I was thinking about the desire to bring the parties together, there are some people who don't want to be in the room with the offenders, the people who've caused them harm. And I just wonder how much that is worked toward, and I imagine you're going to be listening to the victim saying, I don't want to be there.
Yeah, and that's absolutely 100% appropriate and fine. We really want to make sure that victims are empowered and supported, so it's never about forcing them or trying to coerce them into a process for offender rehabilitation or to support the offender, but really about ensuring that their needs are met. So just by providing outreach and listening to them and providing them an opportunity to be acknowledged and get any information that they're needed. So we can still do restorative justice without having a direct encounter. We can still support accountability with our offenders, and we can still ensure that offenders' needs are being met. So it's not always ending in a direct face-to-face encounter.
Restorative justice, the topic here in the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to some folks from the Resolve Center for Dispute Resolution and Restorative Justice based in Medford. Kara Walsh is the Director of Restorative Justice at Resolve. Rafi Kunkel is the Director of Education and School Services, generally applying the principles of restorative justice within the K-12 school system. You may have lots of questions about restorative justice and the practices. We'd like to hear from you at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You might have a story to share as well about being in part of a restorative justice process. 800-838-3760, jx@jeffnet.org. The Northwest Justice Forum coming to Southern Oregon University next Tuesday through Thursday. It looks like May 8th through 10th. Work us through this, then. In fact, let's start at the school level, because it's probably easier for a lot of people to understand. You can kind of give us the K-12 level process. So how is restorative justice used, for example, within a school setting, as you have trained the school systems to do, Rafi?
Yeah, well, I think when we're looking at the application in a school setting, we really characterize it in three different areas. We're thinking about prevention. So how are we building relationships in community proactively, teaching skills to hopefully reduce the amount of harm that actually happens? So what that looks like is classrooms are circling up. They're finding ways to give everybody equal voice in the room, allowing everyone's story to really be told.
You mean literally circling up? So there's no back of the classroom.
Yeah, no back of the classroom. Mm-hmm. Everyone gets to participate. And teachers really like that aspect of it, is that until they really get their students into a circle and offer that equity of voice, they get the same three kids raising their hand over and over and over. So circles happen both to build relationships and community, but also explore curriculum, to check in on goals and progress. So circles are a really great application, and they're teaching students the skills that they need so that if and when harm happens, because it's a normal part of life. Sometimes we make mistakes and conflict comes up. Being able to then circle up in a different setting and know what it means to really have a talking piece in your hand and have it be your turn to really speak, they're able to come forward and take accountability and listen to each other and express themselves in a much stronger way when we actually need to repair from harm.
So by circling up, they're already getting used to facing each other.
Yep.
In that setting, and then, so they're not totally surprised if they get together into a slightly more arduous setting, or at least a place where there's going to be some level of accountability having to be dealt with.
That's the idea. And if whole classrooms experience a harm, or there's a disruption, or teacher goes away and the substitute leaves a note saying the class was really disrespectful, there's already a practice and a mode in place for the whole class to be able to have a conversation about what happened, who was impacted, what they really need to do to make things right, and how they're going to prevent it from happening again.
You mentioned talking piece.
Yeah.
That was interesting. Did you mean like as in talking stick or something like that?
Something like that. A lot of schools like to create their own. I think the important thing is that it should have meaning to the circle keeper, or the person who's really facilitating the process, or the class. But it's really just a visible way of acknowledging whose turn it is and really making sure that we are practicing this process in a way where everybody actually gets a turn to speak and there's real true equity of voice.
So can you give an example of an infraction that has occurred and how a school has dealt with it?
Mm-hmm. A story we tell commonly, and of course we've changed some information just to really maintain confidentiality. We had a student, I'll call him Brandon. He was spending some time with friends on the soccer field, and he was brand new to that school, brand new to the community, really wanting to fit in, was at a choice point, decided to smoke some marijuana. At which point then they're walking past the school and they see the shop door was left open and he was dared to go inside and vandalize a classroom. So he's at a choice point, and he makes the decision that he's going to go inside and vandalize the classroom. So the harm done to the school, the teacher, the community, you can imagine the ripple effect of the custodian cleaning up afterwards, the principal canceling meetings in order to really address the situation, and just what's going to happen afterward. So in a traditional system, Brandon might be in for a suspension. There might be a citing from a police officer or involvement with the criminal justice setting. But in schools that are practicing restorative justice, it might be appropriate to really look at that situation and ask the questions, who's been harmed, what do they need, and what's the best process to engage everybody involved in figuring out how things are going to be made right and how we're going to keep this from happening again.
So was there a criminal justice referral in this case, or was it just dealt with within the school?
Yeah, in this case in particular, it did actually go through the criminal justice system first. And it's a combination of stories, but what had been happening in our community is that schools weren't implementing restorative justice. They didn't have a lot of resources. We hadn't started the work yet. And so it went through the criminal justice system, and then it landed on Kara's desk, and she was able to respond to it in a restorative way just several months after. So schools can do it without engaging the criminal justice system, but...
Okay.
That's also a path.
So great transition there. So then where did the case go from there, Kara Walsh?
So how that happened is I did prep work with everybody, the teacher, the janitor, the custodian, the mother, with Brandon, really ensured that Brandon had the skills and the coaching so that he could really take responsibility. We all came together to have a conversation. Brandon owned his pieces, his different choice points on it, and then everyone had an opportunity to really communicate the impact and without going into the story about it. But then at the end, restorative justice is all about accountability. And so it's not just having a conversation and communicate the feelings, but how do we repair the harm to the extent possible? So there were several agreements that were made. One, that he agreed to come in on his spring break and work alongside the custodian for a full week as a way of really giving back the time, because some of the ink that was on the floor wasn't going to come up. He also agreed to join the track team because they acknowledged that the behavior was a symptom of him not having a lot of friends and needing to develop some positive pro-social support in his life. And he also agreed to do some mentoring in the school, really for younger students, because they recognized that it had a larger impact on the wider school community. So there was definitely a restoration of relationships and community and clear reparation.
So I can hear that certainly for a young person, this is potentially harder than mm-hmm. just being punished, because they are forced to make some admissions about what is lacking and what led them to do what they did in the first place.
Absolutely. I have youth say all the time that they would rather sit in detention than sit across the table from the person that they've harmed, that it is a true act of courage. And the way that we define accountability is, one, acknowledging you caused harm, two, recognizing you made a choice, three, understanding it from the other person's perspective, four, making things right, so taking active measures to repair the harm, and then taking steps to make sure it doesn't happen again. So it's more of an active level of accountability, of having to do something to repair the harm, than more of our traditional punitive models of being expelled or suspended or put in detention can really be more of a passive, this is happening to them.
It's not like solitary or detention. It's not like being sent away, in essence. Mm-hmm. It's really having to take part in the process of fixing things.
Yeah. And it can be really, really challenging to hear the direct impact that your actions have had on someone. And that is often where, I mean, one of the impacts of restorative justice is just the reduction of recidivism. And one of the reasons that they have identified that is the building of empathy. When I know that what I do affects other people, it increases empathy and can reduce the recidivism in the future.
We're talking restorative justice with Kara Walsh and Rafi Kunkel from the Resolve Center for Dispute Resolution and Restorative Justice, formerly Mediation Works, based in Medford, one of the organizations involved in next week's Northwest Justice Forum about restorative justice. That's Tuesday through Thursday at Southern Oregon University. You can join the conversation now. You may have many questions about restorative justice and how the processes work, or maybe have been exposed to it in one way or another. We would like to hear from you at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So how many different schools in the area that Resolve serves, Rafi, are now using restorative justice practices? How many districts?
Three districts and 13 schools this year. So in about 2014-15, that academic year, we started our very first pilot with the Phoenix Talent School District in Phoenix High School. And since then, we've just grown from one school to four schools to eight schools to this year really working with 13. And there are even more that I'm hearing from that are really interested in starting this work and getting involved.
Just in terms of results, are the schools that have been participating, particularly Phoenix High School for the last 4 years or so, noticing any reduction in infractions or in issues because of the fact that restorative justice is now part of the process?
They are. This year, Phoenix High School is experiencing yet again their, I think, fourth year with no expulsions. They've seen decreases in suspensions. We've seen increases in graduation rates and attendance rates, decreases in referrals. So we are seeing a positive impact. And again, I think that's all great and wonderful, and we want to be working toward those things too. But we really implement restorative justice because we believe that these principles and these practices are good for people who've been harmed, good for people who cause harm, and really positive for our community.
How time-consuming is restorative justice? Mm-hmm. I mean, I can see where just, okay, I'm going to write your referral, you're going to detention, yep. Here's your sheet of paper, don't come see me again. There's a different process involved with restorative justice.
There is, and it takes a lot of time and a lot of resource, and I think that's one of the things that Resolve is really, we really work hard to make sure schools have enough resource to be able to do this. But I think for schools and districts that are interested in really getting started, really examining who in your building can be a restorative justice specialist, how can they take time out of their day every day to really respond to students and families and teachers and other administrators and be able to really work with them to make sure their needs are really met.
So beyond the school system then, Kara Walsh, in the criminal justice system, I mean, we talked about it being in place in the juvenile system. Is it used much above the juvenile system, though, in the adult criminal justice system?
Mm-hmm. It is. On a local level, we haven't yet developed partnership to be doing it in our adult system. We are working in partnership with our youth correctional facility, a part of a statewide system of the Oregon Youth Authority, mm-hmm. the Rogue Valley Youth Correctional Facility out in Grants Pass. And so it's been really, we've been working in partnership with them, providing training and consultation and coaching, and they're really interested in incorporating in their already existing positive human development model to, so out in so in a more statewide correctional facility, we're seeing it be really efficacious as well.
Is that by design, that you want to make sure that you get it established with younger people first, that, you know, juvenile offenders, younger offenders will get to know the system so that it can potentially be marched up into the adult criminal justice system?
I don't think it's necessarily done by design. I think
people generally believe that youth have the ability to change and change fast, and they want to focus on the youth and really make sure that they have skills to really develop and change their behaviors. But I think there's a lot of really successful models out there that work with adults, even who have committed serious and violent crimes.
Well, that was the next question. Mm-hmm. If there's a limit to the cases you can do this with, but I mean, does it go all the way up to murder cases?
It goes all the way up. In the state of Oregon, we have a facilitated dialogue program through the Department of Corrections that does restorative justice for serious and violent crimes. So it's always victim initiated, and obviously a lot of preparation and time and care that goes into each case. But this restorative justice is not just about low level offenses for juveniles. I think it's a paradigm, it's a set of principles and values, and can really be applied to different settings.
At the heart of this all, I still find myself coming back to the ways in which parents will train kids to come back and say, be sorry and be honest about it. Say, I am sorry for, and make a real apology of it. I mean, is this really what's at the core of restorative justice?
Well, we tell the youth all the time, or those that we're working with, is you don't have to be sorry, but you do have to take responsibility. And I think actually being able to differentiate those for people who've caused harm is really important, because oftentimes people cause harm because they've been victimized, whether by the person who they've harmed or just by society or just a system of systemic harm that they have been part of. So it's not a requirement or prerequisite or what this is about, but there's a difference between really being able to take responsibility, being able to say, I caused harm and I made these choices and I affected you, and I'm going to do whatever I need to do to really repair the harm and look at the deeper issues. But it's not necessarily about being sorry. And often my experience is people may not be sorry initially going into a conversation, but after they really start going through a process or really understanding the deeper level of the impact that their actions have had on someone else, an apology may naturally arise, but it's never something that we would force As is, we don't force forgiveness on someone who's been harmed. Mm-hmm. So that may be a natural outcropping of what happens, but also that's not what this is about.
Grab the headphones. Let's take a phone call here. We're talking about criminal justice with Kara Walsh and Rafi Kunkel from the Resolve Center for Dispute Resolution and Restorative Justice. Here's Lysel in Grants Pass. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And thank you so much for the work that you're doing. I'm just really, really excited to hear about this happening in our area. And I'm really curious. My question is where your funding comes from at this point, if there's any hope in the foreseeable future of perhaps your funding actually coming directly through the criminal justice system, whether that's for juveniles and or adults. And then I also would love to hear more. I think you said that at least in the adult criminal justice system that your work needs to be initiated by the victim. But, yeah, I'm just curious how people get into your on your path of restorative justice if they're in the criminal justice.
All right. Thanks for that, Lysel. Appreciate it. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you for that question. Resolve is a nonprofit organization, so our funding comes from a number of different places. It's kind of a mix of fee-for-service, so we do have contracts with our partners, and they do find money to pitch in to make this work happen. We also are able to really write for grants and receive grant funding as well as donations. So I think it's really a mix for us of how we make sure that this funding can happen. I think anything we can do as a community to keep advocating for this work, because I think the state and even, you know, our nation should really pay attention and find ways to create more sustainable funding to make sure that this is happening.
And the other question from Lysel was about how to make use of your services.
Yeah. Well, we have partnerships with our existing organizations, so referrals can come directly in, but we also just respond to any type of, we respond to community cases as well, so people can access our services by giving us a call. And just to clarify, the Department of Corrections, the facilitated dialogue program that deals specifically with serious and violent crime, those are the ones that are specifically victim initiated. However, restorative justice can still be initiated within the adult system by supporting offender accountability first.
Just seconds left, but what I'm hearing is really kind of a removal of the people in the middle, getting the fact that you need to be aware of the fact that there's a person harmed by your actions.
It's a real community relational response to harm and wrongdoing that really engages.
Kara Walsh and Rafi Kunkel from the Resolve Center for Dispute Resolution and Restorative Justice. Thanks so much. The Northwest Justice Forum next Tuesday through Thursday in Ashland.